Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, President Obama and his new Secretary of State, John Kerry, are facing a series of foreign policy challenges, or foreign challenges, and if you start listing them, you go on and on. And so it's maybe you, like me, wonder how they are going to deal with them, how they ought to deal with them. And so I've invited the Richard Krasno Distinguished Professor of History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Klaus Larris, who's developed in a relatively short time on this campus a phenomenal reputation as someone who follows a whole wide variety of these foreign policy challenges. And Professor Larris, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
What if you were John Kerry and were thrown into the leadership of the State Department and following, you know, a pretty strong predecessor who put her stamp on that office? What would you be? I mean, where do you go? What do you do first?
Well, yeah. I mean, it would be nice to have John Kerry's position. It's a great job, I think. He gets to travel an awful lot. But of course, there are, as you rightly said, there are plenty of challenges which he is faced with. I think he actually started off well. He went to Europe first to see the British Prime Minister, the German Chancellor, the French President, and other leaders in Europe and then beyond in the Middle East. And I think that has made a nice change, because we have heard an awful lot about the Asian pivot recently, that the United States is above all focusing on China, on Asia, on Southeast Asia, and sort of neglecting perhaps the Middle East and Europe a little bit. At least that was the interpretation which was around in the Middle East and in Europe. Of course, the Obama White House disputed that, said we are doing both, you know, we are looking after all the areas in the world. But there was the impression that the United States is perhaps too strongly focused on Asia. That was the impression in Europe. So John Kerry's journey to Europe has kind of rectified that. And I think it is still true that when you look around at the world, and it's a very many challenges around now, the only real reliable ally the United States has is Europe, as the various individual countries in Europe, and of course the European Union as the umbrella organization. And I think that gradually has also dawned on the Obama administration that one should really pay greater attention again to Europe and look after them. Because think of the Afghanistan war, for example. Most of the allies who were there were Europeans, and they did the fighting. They, you know, supported the United States a lot. Of course, they didn't support the United States without grumbling and a certain disenchantment about what was going on. But in the last resort, if there's enough pressure put on them, the Europeans usually show up and do what is expected of them, at least to some extent. And you can't, when you look at China, at Brazil, at India, at Russia, then, you know, they are not as supportive of the United States as the Europeans are. And so I think John Kerry did the right thing.
So you're going to see your best friends first.
Indeed. Yes, that is what I say. And also you want to obtain their support for solving the Israeli-Palestinian problem, which is, as you know, very, very difficult, almost impossible, I would say. But you also need them when you confront China. And of course, the word confront is a strong one, and the Obama administration wouldn't use that word. You know, it's more like strategic partnership, cooperation, friendly cooperation, and a little bit of competition here and there. But what it really is, it's a power political battle in Asia about influence in an important region of the world.
Other than rebuilding or renewing and strengthening our relationships with our best friends in Europe, where do we need to go next?
We need to go to the Middle East and again tackle the Israel-Palestinian problem. You know, this two-state solution has been around for many years, has been talked about, is probably the only reasonable attempt to overcome that problem, but it has been stymied by the Israeli leadership at the moment. It has been stymied by the Palestinians themselves to some extent, and I think a new approach needs to be made. And with a new Secretary of State, and with John Kerry's formidable reputation as a foreign policy expert and a former presidential candidate who is well regarded, I think, almost all over the world, I think that is the opportunity to do something about it too. The United States is, you know, comes across still as a neutral, sort of neutral arbiter in that problem. And that influence needs to be brought to the table again.
I worry about having throwing a Secretary of State or anyone in the administration into that when the prospects seem at this point in time so difficult for any solution to go because of the strong positions on both sides that do not tilt towards a solution at this point.
There's something in that, but I think I believe in presidential leadership, particularly in a second term, when the president and people in his administration do not need to run again. And of course, there's a great risk. It may fail, and we are not better off than today. But the chances of something achieving something like a more permanent solution are there. And I think for the United States, still the superpower in the world, still the by far most influential, strongest power in the world, if the United States and a new Secretary of State doesn't try, who's going to try? So I think there is a certain responsibility on the shoulders of the leader of the strongest nation in the world. And of course, he has to run the risk of failure. But that failure, I think, would be a failure which was, not surprising. Everyone would still applaud him for trying, and not everything you try succeeds. Yeah. But if you not succeed, you know, what's happening?
Well, I just push you back. You said go first to Europe, where we have the potential for a great relationship if we pay attention to it. So the payback for a little bit of work in Europe is so great. The payback for a lot of work on the Middle East situation, that is particularly the settlement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, seems to be just a sump hole of effort with no reward. There doesn't. And well, so let me ask you this:
Oh, yeah.
What if you are suggesting that John Kerry spent a lot of time there, what would be the program that you could convince him might be workable for the solution of that?
Obama is going to the West Bank. He's going to Israel soon. And I think that should be the beginning of a new initiative in the peace process. And once Obama have been and with all that tension, then the State Department needs to take over and try to get the two sides to the negotiating table. That
they're
is
not, they're not just two sides, though, are they?
No, well, true. But of course, but we are talking about mostly about the Israelis and the Palestinians, and they need to find some sort of, and of course,
the
Palestinians are themselves split among at least two factions. And of course, you need to get all factions around the table. But I think you need to start something like the Oslo process again, a multilateral negotiating process involving all Palestinian factions, involving Israel, possibly involving some of the neighboring states like Jordan. And, use the political influence of the Europeans, for example. The Germans have actually a quite strong influence on Israel. Not necessarily a decisive influence, but they can also be asked to be involved and twist arms. I'm not saying that the prospects of success are great, but if you don't try, the prospects are even less good.
More immediate and possibly more susceptible to better results from good policy. You're talking about Israel's neighbors, and we've got a situation in Syria, which is complex. And although not on the headlines, the situation in Egypt may be even more important for us in terms of long term. And how do those two countries rate in terms of the attention that's required by the Secretary of State now?
Egypt used to be a very important ally of the United States. Was the only Middle Eastern country which had a peace process instigating a peace and a peace agreement with Israel, and of course that has all changed in the course of the Arab Spring. Now we have the Muslim Brotherhood in power in Cairo, by itself a very controversial government within the country. It certainly is a government which is not as pro-Western as the Mubarak government was, and that also explains the reason why the United States and other Western countries hesitated to actually call for Mubarak's dismissal or deposition from power for quite a little while before they then basically didn't have a choice but to go along with that calls for Mubarak's toppling. The United States has much less influence on and in Egypt now than it used to have. It still has a little bit of influence. It still pays quite a bit of military aid annually. It still trains Egyptian military officers and has good links to the Egyptian military. So I wouldn't say that the United States has lost all influence, but compared to the Mubarak era, it has really significantly diminished. And I think to rely on Egypt as far as the Israeli-Palestinian peace process is concerned is pretty hopeless. helpless at the moment because they are so occupied with themselves. The same applies to, for other trouble spots in the Middle East, like Syria or like Iran. I think Egypt is an unpredictable has an unpredictable role at the moment, and you don't know how things will pan out in Egypt. So it's very difficult to predict anything. Morsi himself, the Egyptian president, is very controversial among his country. He may not be in power for all that long, though the situation has come down a little bit again compared to a few weeks ago. And I think the United States keeps a kind of quiet approach to Egypt at the moment in order not to be seen as being disturbing the situation even further.
We're talking about the foreign policy challenges that face John Kerry, the new Secretary of State, and President Obama. We're talking with Professor Klaus Laris. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Talking about foreign policy, we have a relatively new Secretary of State, a president who now is not eligible for re-election. He's in his second term. He's got some restraints and got some opportunities trying to quiz one of the America's leading experts on foreign policy here at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Professor Klaus Laris. Now, anybody who listens to you understands that you, like the other German who came to teach us about foreign policy, Henry Kissinger, have a little bit of an accent. Not much, though. Not much.
Well, but the German... think Kissinger's accent is stronger, and it gets stronger the older he gets.
He left as a little boy, but he's still his accent is still strong.
Well, some people say that he develops his accent deliberately in order to make a difference. I don't know whether that is correct.
You're not doing that, are you?
No. I'm trying to be just natural.
Well, as we were talking about Middle East, and there just seems to be you can stop anywhere, and you've got a potential crisis in the Middle East.
Indeed.
The place that I guess you suggested we might need to talk about, and of course, is Iran, and that's another very difficult. I restrain myself in offering any suggestions because it's just a tough.
It is a very difficult situation. I mean, we of course also have to ask us whether if the Iran developed a nuclear bomb, whether it would be as terrible as seems to be the impression created by the press, both in Europe and in the United States, and maybe by our leading politicians as well. I wonder. I don't think that an Iranian nuclear bomb will immediately lead to an Iranian attack on Israel or any other country in the world. So I think we shouldn't, over-exaggerate the consequences. If
what you're saying is, you say it so calmly, but that's very controversial.
I think it, of course, if Iran develops an atomic bomb, I think it will shift the balance of power in the Middle East. It will scare a lot of countries like Israel, also Saudi Arabia. They won't like it. So I'm not in favor of Iran developing a nuclear bomb. And if that can be prevented, that is the best of all solutions. But in the worst case scenario, if Iran does develop a nuclear bomb for some reason or other, I don't think it's the end of the world or the end of the Middle East. So even if they have a nuclear bomb, we can still engage with them in a diplomatic way. So we shouldn't panic totally, if something like that happens. It's not the end of the world. There are lots of other countries who have an atomic bomb, like India and Pakistan, particularly Pakistan, not a particularly stable country. But we don't really hear much about the debate about the Pakistani nuclear weapons. At the time when it was developed, both India and Pakistan, the United States was more than miffed and almost broke off diplomatic relations. They, hardly talked to them. Then they re-engaged again because they realized now they have the bomb. We can't just shut them out and isolate them. We have to engage. And that is what has happened. And something similar could happen with Iran. Having said that, of course, everything should be done to prevent them obtaining a nuclear bomb. And the way to do it is not a military attack, neither by Israel nor by the United States. That will only cause another major war in the Middle East, which we really don't need. We also can't afford it, by the way. And it will also rally the Iranian population behind the clerical regime in Iran. At the moment, the regime in Iran is not very popular with its own people. There's a deep economic crisis. There's lots of economic and financial problems. So the regime is actually not particularly popular. And there's a lot of pro-American sentiments, particularly among the younger population in Iran. As soon as you attack the regime or Iran with a military attack, the people will undoubtedly rally against the regime. Well, and people, you don't want to do that.
Yeah, well, people will say, we've been waiting for these young people who've been supposedly pro-American. We've been waiting for them for now almost 40 years.
And it's a different matter whether we wait for them to rise up and topple a regime. You know, the regime has dictatorial powers. It really is a police regime. And if you rise up or if you criticize your regime, you endanger your own life, the life of your family. That sometimes happens in world history. Like, look at the Arab Spring or look at the revolutions in Europe in 1989-90, which brought about the end of the Cold War. But that was extremely courageous. You know, can you really encourage young people in Iran to rise up and endanger their life and face torture and put their families at risk? I think that's a very, we ask them to do something. Would we do it ourselves? You know, it's a very risky thing to do. So, I think we have to be careful to being too hopeful.
Right. No, I agree with you 100% about that. But to say we should not either attack Iran or wink at Israel and say, go ahead and take out this, you say that's because we'll lose the support of the younger generation who are disenchanted with the regime. But you've already persuaded me that disenchantment leads nowhere.
Even if it doesn't, I don't think it will lead to a toppling of the regime. But are you really encouraging us to start another major war in the Middle East?
Well, let's talk about that. I think that's a fair question, and the answer to the question is absolutely not.
Good,
but the absolute answer does not preclude what might be sold to us as a surgical strike. By a country which is more threatened, feels more threatened.
There were surgical strikes before, for example, by Israel on Iraq at the time in the late 1990s. Also recently, there probably was a surgical strike on Syrian development in that area. But as far as I understand, the Iranians, of course, expect something like that. So they have now distributed their nuclear armaments industry all over the country, put it underground. So a surgical strike may actually not achieve what we want to achieve by eliminating or stopping that nuclear program. It would, of course, do some damage to some extent, like cyber warfare. American cyber warfare against Iran with the worm they put into their computers has delayed and damage the nuclear attempts in Iran, but it hasn't really brought it to an end.
Excuse me help me on the facts. Yeah. Is what we know about the cyber attack on Iran? Do we know where this came from?
Or no one says, "Oh, we did it." But there's strong suspicions that it really originated
in the
United States.
Rather than Israel. It's
probably a combination of both. But I think the American may have played the lead. Role. That is, I can't say that for sure, but that is what I've been reading. And it doesn't really matter whether it was mainly the Israelis or mainly an American anti-cyber warfare agency. The fact is that the Western world, put it that way, that the West really used cyber warfare to delay or to attempt to eliminate the nuclear program in Iran. While it definitely has done a lot of damage, it has delayed the program, it hasn't eliminated it. Mm-hmm. And a surgical strike would probably achieve the same. It would not eliminate it. So what we are talking about when we talk about the real elimination of the nuclear program in Iran is a major military attack, probably a toppling of the regime, really. And that would, of course,
Another Iraq. Take that. So, because there are people there are some strong voices in favor of that, in favor of pushing the possibility. Even the president doesn't take it off the table. So
let me just remind you, during the Bush administration, I can't remember the precise year, I think it was 2005, 2006, there was a lot of talk that the next attack would be on Iran. And there, you know, I wasn't privy to these discussions, obviously. What one could read was that some policymakers were moving kind of close to that idea. And the American military published an open letter where all the military, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and other senior military urgently warned against doing that, and that killed it. And I can't see that the situation has changed now. Another major war in the Middle East would be disastrous. And I don't think that the military option to eliminate the Iranian program is on the table at all, or should be on the table at all. I think it needs to be diplomacy negotiations. And here we need to see another effort by the Obama administration to do that, in cooperation with the Europeans, of course. Yeah.
We're visiting with Professor Klaus Lehrers. We're talking about the challenges that face the new Secretary of State and the second-term president. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Professor Klaus Lehrers is my guest. He's the Richard Krasno Distinguished Professor of History here, and comes from a distinguished career of service on both sides of the Atlantic. And really, I'm learning from you, and I appreciate the wisdom that you bring to the table. I want to, in talking about the Middle East, we very seldom talk about the positives, you know, the things that seem positive. And I wonder, the neighbor to Syria and Iran and Iraq is Turkey. And we get mixed signals from Turkey, but all in all, it looks like a vibrant economy. It looks like a democracy. While the leaders are not ones that I would choose, they seem to be basically pragmatic people, and that they if they continue to have their aspirations to join Europe, it looks like that might be an evolving prospect. How do, as a German, how do you feel about that? Is that a good sunny spot for us in the Middle East?
First of all, yeah, Turkey has developed very well. It has a flourishing economy, much to everyone's surprise. It is an increasingly important country because of its geographical position. It borders Syria, for example. It has increasingly played a bit of a mediator role in many conflicts in the area. And it is, of course, a member of NATO, which makes it part of the Western camp, so to speak. However, there have also been some less encouraging developments. For example, only this morning, or yesterday it was, the new Secretary of State, John Kerry, said that he was displeased by the remarks about Erdogan, the Turkish leader, about Zionism and the Jewish state. And there's also a tendency, as far as I can see, to move away from the secular setup in Turkey towards a more Muslim, fundamentalist-orientated state. And that worries a lot of Europeans. And we, of course, don't know how that will pan out. A lot of things which are being said and done is, of course, also for domestic consumption in Turkey. You know, politicians there have to win votes and elections as well. So that differs very little from Western societies. If you took every word a politician said in the United States at face value, then, you know, then that would be probably not a good idea. The same applies to Turkey. Regarding Turkish membership of the EU, prospective membership of the EU, that is very controversial. While Turkey started applying, actually, or applying for to become a candidate in the 1960s. So, you know, they have been asking for becoming a member for a long time. Since the 2000s, they have actually got official candidate stature, and the process of negotiation is going to take place. But it is controversial. First of all, because of the huge population of Turkey. Turkey would be the most populous country in the EU if they were admitted. Then the economy of Turkey is booming, but there are large parts of Turkey which are still hugely agricultural. you may even say, quite remote and not all that developed. And there's something like the structural funds within the European Union. Once you become a member and you have areas in your country, regions in your country, which are less well developed, you can apply to obtain structural funds to...
From everybody.
Mm-hmm. It's an EU pot, but everyone pays in that. For example, the Irish, for a long time, they got lots of structural funds because they also were a huge they had a huge agricultural population. But Ireland is not a huge country compared to Turkey. So the areas and regions in Turkey which need developing would require a lot of structural funding. And of course, the currently existing EU countries feel in two minds about supporting that because it will cost a lot of money. So it's a financial aspect and also then a cultural aspect. And would the Turks really fit into a Christian-dominated Europe? And here religion comes and culture comes in it again. And while the United States argues that it would be a great opportunity for Europe to have a Muslim state within its borders, and you know it would really be a good sign, a symbolic sign to show to the Middle East and other parts of the world that the EU isn't just a Christian-dominated club. The Europeans themselves say, yes, in theory that sounds great, but we will have to deal with it in practice. It's not; it goes beyond mere, you know, nice symbols. We really have to extend the money. We will have to integrate them culturally. Then you look towards Germany. In Germany, there have been quite a rich number of Turkish guest workers since the 1970s, if not earlier, 60s. And many of those have not really been well integrated. And not because the German state didn't make an effort. Often you find that the Turkish people in Germany were not all that keen of being integrated. While they work and do pay their taxes, that is all fine. They have also set up their own little communities in Turkey where Turkish is spoken, where they hardly speak German, where literacy rates even in Turkish but also in German are very low. And even the younger generation, Turkish people who were born in Germany, find it difficult to be fully integrated. Though, of course, the situation is a lot better now than it used to be 10 or 20 years ago.
Germans don't have the same, if you're born here, you're a citizen rule.
No, right? But it has been e-citizen. The citizenship laws in Germany have been eased since the Schröder government of the mid-2000s. So it is quite possible to obtain German citizenship if you are Turkish but were born in Germany or grew up in Germany. That has, in the 1980s, 1970s, 1990s, that was much more difficult. Since the Schröder government, it has become a lot, and it was long overdue, actually.
So what do you do? I speak German, I grew up,
the dilemma for many young Turkish people is that they do speak German, that they go to German schools, that they also have a cultural background in Turkey because of their families. Often they neither feel German nor do they feel Turkish.
But what are the requirements for citizenship? Do you have to show your true allegiance to Germany rather than
residence,
Turkey's?
No, residence, really.
Long-term residence.
Exactly. And if you were born there and you go to school there, then, citizenship
even if
for
you
young,
still speak Turkish and wear a fez.
Yes, you do not have to take a literacy test. So some people argue that should be done, and of course it also varies according to region, but that is not the requirement.
Well, I could talk about that all day, but now that we're talking about Europe, and you're an expert on Great Britain and its relationship to Europe over a long period of time.
Yes.
And how does Great Britain fit into Europe and with several factors? You know, you have a government that is increasingly uncomfortable with even any talk of monetary union with Europe. You have a large group of people in Scotland saying they want to disintegrate Great Britain. And you have a strong political movement seems to be developing in Britain, not a majority by any means, of saying, we're tired of sending our money to Brussels and having our laws made in Brussels.
Yeah. How does Britain fit into Europe? Badly, I would say. At least that's the way it looks at the moment. I used to live in Britain for a long time, for almost 18 years. So, and it was very difficult to find a really pro-Europe enthusiast in
Britain.
Really?
Is that right?
More so among, let's say, the academic community, the student community. They are more inclined to look favorably on Europe. But the average man and woman in the street, read, who's not, let's say, academically interested, finds it much more difficult to develop an interest. And that goes back a long time, but particularly, of course, there's still the channel between continental Europe and Britain. The channel is not that big, but it seems to be bigger than it is. And, of course, there's the old empire and the victory in the Second World War. You know, Britain won the war, the Germans, of course, and the French, they all lost the war and were conquered by Hitler, while the British were on the same level as the Soviet Union and the United States as a victorious country. And empire legacy, that really is still important.
So Churchill, your friend Churchill still lives.
He does. But Churchill actually was, I would say he was more open towards Europe than many current day British politicians are. Britain, when first the ideas for European integration were launched with the Schuman Plan of 1950, Britain refused to join. They didn't want to merge themselves with these downtrodden countries on the European continent. They saw themselves on the same level, as I said, with the United States and the Soviet Union. It took until 1973 until they eventually joined. They'd asked actually twice in the 1960s, but were repulsed by French President de Gaulle. De Gaulle feared British competition within the EU. At the time, he also feared that via Britain, the United States would be, meddling in EC affairs. So he didn't want the British in. After the death of de Gaulle after he retired in 1969, the French became a little bit more open. So 73, the British were admitted, but immediately they started renegotiating the treaty, and then they held a referendum, which turned out to be in favor of the EC. But the very fact they had just been admitted, and the next government says, oh, now we need to renegotiate our conditions for being let in. That tells you something about the torn attitude in Britain. And then, of course, the climax came with Mrs. Thatcher in the 1980s, and Thatcher increasingly turned against anti-Europe. And when you look at Thatcher's speeches as leader of the opposition between 1975 and 1979, she was actually quite pro-Europe. She gave a speech in Rome in 1977. She talked about Britain being at the heart of Europe, Britain being one of the very pro-European country, and the Conservative Party being, you know, Europe's closest friend in Britain. You wouldn't hear that today, and you couldn't hardly believe it, you know, if you replayed these clips. So a lot has changed, and what has changed is really the idea about supranationality, that there should be a united Europe. While that was written down in the Rome Treaties of 1957, the British never read it or never believed it. What they want from Europe is a single market. They want a free trade association within Europe so that they can trade easily and very well with the European continent. But they do not want to give up national sovereignty. They do not want to have a united Europe. And of course, the ambition of all the other EU countries is to eventually create a united Europe. We already have a united European currency, the euro, and the British and some other countries have not participated in that. So increasingly we see a two-tier Europe, you know, a very closely integrated one, which wants to go further than Europe and have a proper European United State, which will take a long time, but at least the direction seems to be clear for these, while the British want to stop where it is. They say, yes, single market, close trade relationships, the rest we don't really need. And that is the discussion at the moment. And the British government under Prime Minister Cameron basically says, we want to get some of our powers back from Brussels, some of the powers in social legislation, welfare legislation, judicial legislation, which we transferred to Europe in the last decades or so. We want to claim some of these powers back. And that, of course, has created a crisis in the EU, not as big as the crisis which we see with the euro crisis, but it is has met with a great deal of displeasure.
Can Europe get along without Britain?
Theoretically, yes. The question is actually, can Britain go along with Europe without doing any harm to itself? And even the United States, in the form of Assistant Secretary of State Philip Gordon, recently warned the British that that wouldn't be the case. He believes that Europe within the EU is a much, I mean, Britain within the EU, EU is a much stronger country, also a much more useful country for the United States than a Britain floating alone in a very big world. Imagine the British negotiating a trade deal with the Chinese by themselves. Who's going to win that negotiating process? Britain, as part of the EU, being a member of a 27 nation club with a population of over 300 million, is a very different matter. Only the problem is the British themselves don't seem to realize
that way. Well, we're visiting with Professor Klaus Lehrhus. We're talking about the many multifaceted challenges that face John Kerry as the new Secretary of State. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Professor Klaus Lehrhus, and we're talking about foreign policy challenges for the new Secretary of State and the second-term president. And we've talked a lot. I mean, there are a lot of problems that we've talked about, but there are a whole lot that we haven't even touched on. What would you say is the most important areas that we've missed talking about?
Well, clearly China. I mean, China is really the challenger to the United States in almost all respects, in trade respects, in economic respects, in geopolitical, power political respects. And the United States is worried about China. Not as an imminent threat, like a military threat, something like that. That is not on the agenda. Also not as a threat to America's position in the world in the next few years. Or also China's military is, that is not the case. For example, if you think 47% of all military spending in the entire world is done by the United States. I think the Chinese statistic is something like 5%. So the gap is still huge, and you don't catch up within a few years. So in a way, the United States still has nothing to fear. However, in Southeast Asia, sometimes also to some extent in Africa, the Chinese throw their weight about. They're clearly about to want to be regarded as a coming superpower, as a great power already, and they want to make sure that they're being respected and have a lot of influence. And they challenge the United States, particularly in an economic and trade way. And the United States has become worried that they need to pay attention to that. And when we had Obama recently visiting Southeast Asia in November of 2012, the main reason he went was to show or to make an appearance to show China and to show the smaller countries in that region that the United States has not abdicated, that the United States feels that is also its sphere of influence. And, of course, the United States has two oceans to deal with, the Pacific and the Atlantic. Mm. And Obama clearly wanted to make clear that it wasn't just the Atlantic he was concerned about. Well, and let me just say that. Yeah. And the smaller countries in the region are worried by China. China has a lot of influence, a lot of soft power, and they can easily be put under pressure by China. And so they want to balance the Chinese and the Americans. They don't want to turn up totally in a Chinese orbit where they can't really stand up to a big power like China. But of course, they don't want to become satellites to the United States either. They really want to be non-allied and play off the two superpowers in order to obtain some level of independence. Then again, when you look at what has happened in Burma recently, that very positive democratic development in Burma, strongly supported by the United States, also actually by the Europeans, that's a very positive development. But of course, Burma is still not a proper flourishing democracy, and economically, there's a huge potential for development. But one reason why Obama, for example, made a strenuous effort to do something about Burma was because of China, to stop Chinese influence in the region. And if Burma does become a proper democracy, that, of course, would be something which would not be to the advantage of the Chinese.
Well, we hear more about North Korea than China. And is that a wrong prioritization of our challenges in that region?
Well, North Korea has become a challenger because of its kind of rogue status as a nuclear power, which does seem to do what it wants and even defeats its protector, China, in going along with test explosions of nuclear bombs and testing of missiles. I don't think that North Korea is a real threat, definitely not to the Western world. To South Korea, of course, it could be a threat if it wanted to be. But I would expect that the Chinese will put some pressure on North Korea to behave more, to behave better, and to restrain themselves. So far, of course, you say that hasn't worked, but they could, because North Korea, in the end, is economically almost totally dependent on China. If the Chinese really put economic pressure on North Korea, the country would collapse within a few weeks or months. And so far, they have not done that, probably because it's a nice pinprick in the sight of the West. But I really don't think that North Korea will be that much of an international danger.
Well, Professor Klaus Laris, thank you for sharing your thoughts about the multifaceted challenges that the United States faces foreign policy-wise. I'm not going to sleep as well tonight.
It was a great pleasure to be here. And let me add, John Kerry's job is still a good one.
That's great. Well, thanks, and hope you'll come back and as we watch how this develops and visit with us again. Again, thanks to Professor Laris. Thanks to you for listening. This has been D.G. Martin and Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.